Beyond the Dark on Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin D. Randall. 80 books and the latest crash, where the UFOs fall from the sky, a history of famous incidents, conspiracies and cover-ups. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
80 books? That's a lot of books.
Well, actually it's 112.
Oh! Make me a liar for 30 books.
That's an old number, several years old.
That's amazing, though. So you must enjoy writing.
It beats heavy lifting.
Sense of humor as well.
Well. There you go.
There you go. What's your interest in UFOs? I mean, it must be absolutely fascinating. Tell us who Kevin is.
Well, I'm a former retired military officer. I have a PhD in psychology. I've been studying the UFO field probably for 40 years now, 45 years. It's a fascinating story because what it does is it tells us that interstellar flight is possible. We spend all this time with our scientific community talking about the vast distances between here and there, and that we cannot possibly make those trips. But if we are in fact being visited by alien creatures, then interstellar flight is possible, and I think that's just a fascinating thing to study. So I've been looking at it from the point of view of let's bring scientific methodology to study of UFOs. Let's try to create a wealth of well-reported information, not anecdotal sightings, but scientific observation, and see if we can't learn something that'll help us advance our knowledge.
Kevin, I have a very, very open mind. I certainly not got a closed mind. But why would they come here? Why this planet?
Because there's a civilization here. I think if I'm a space faring race and I discover another intelligent species, wherever they happen to be, even if we're in an out-of-the-way part of the galaxy as we are, I would think that I would be very interested in their development to see how their society is progressing and compare it to how our society is progressing. Maybe they look at us as creatures who engage in tribal warfare as to the exclusion of great scientific advancement. Maybe they see something in the society that mirrors their own society. But I think if you've discovered another intelligent life form that is on the verge of stepping into space, that would be something of great interest to you.
What do you think they are, and where do you think they are, in your opinion?
I believe that they're alien creatures. I mean, they've developed on a planet, I was going to say much like ours, but not necessarily like ours, but I mean developed in the way that we have, and they're from a planet revolving around another star. I don't know how close they are. I don't know how far away they are. I mean, we don't understand interstellar flight. So the vast distances, once you've solved the problem of dealing with those distances, the travel across the galaxy, which is, you could say, 100,000 light years, may be as simple as traveling 40 or 50 light years. We simply know nothing about the process, so they could be virtually anywhere in the galaxy. But I would suspect that they come from a planet much closer than that they're probably within 50 or 100 light years of Earth, but I simply don't know where they're from. But it's an alien race, intelligent creatures who've developed a society and a science that has allowed them to travel interstellar distances.
Do you believe people are kidnapped?
No, I don't. I looked at that in great depth. A friend of mine, Russ Estes, and the psychologist, Dr. Bill Cohn, and I did a book called The Abduction Enigma, where we looked at this idea of alien abduction. And our conclusions, based on the information we had then, and this was 10, 15 years ago, but based on the information we had then, we concluded that the answers for alien abduction are terrestrially based. And I've seen nothing in the last 15 years that would suggest that there is an alien component to abduction. There are some cases that are very intriguing that may suggest that, but I don't think that we're having anywhere near the numbers that are claimed and the way it's being done. I just don't accept that.
I'm talking to Dr. Kevin D. Randall about what is out there, and this man is a prolific writer. everybody is hungry for evidence. Everybody wants to be, they want to see black and white. Is Roswell the nearest we've got to it?
Roswell suffers from a lack of physical evidence. We have a great deal of eyewitness testimony. And what annoys me is, of course, when the skeptics and the debunkers say, well, it's all anecdotal testimony. And my question is, when does anecdotal testimony become scientific observation? At what point do you decide that the people who are describing what they saw at Roswell are describing accurately what they saw? But I think there's other cases that bring the evidence, bring more chains of evidence to the table than Roswell does. There's a case in Livelland, Texas in 1957 where the UFO interacted with the environment, meaning that it had some kind of a electromagnetic field that stalled car engines, dimmed headlights, filled radios with static. People at least 13 separate locations scattered around Texas, the panhandle of Texas, reported this thing. There, it was seen on the ground. It was seen by law enforcement officers. It was seen by firefighters. There's even evidence that there was some kind of a landing trace. Now, had in 1957 we investigated that as we should have, we might be having a completely different conversation because we had the eyewitness testimony. We had the physical traces on the ground. We had the instrumentality that reacted to the UFO. And I think that's a very good case that deserved, at that time, much a greater research. The problem is we're now more than 50 years beyond that case, and the witnesses are gone, and any possibility of finding the physical trace is gone. And we lost a wonderful opportunity with that case. There are the cases, Ubatuba in Brazil, again in 1957, where bits of metal from a craft were picked up, and they're still arguing about whether or not this metal represents a technology that is advanced further than ours was in 1957. So there's some good physical evidence cases. There are cases where the craft interacted with the instrumentality, radar cases, for example, where the object is seen on the radar and the object is seen in the sky. And there's any number of good landing trace cases. Bentwaters in Great Britain, for example, is a wonderful case where you have some physical evidence, you have some very credible witnesses telling a story that makes sense. So there's some very good evidence out there. You just have to pick and choose the cases.
Tell me, are governments stifling information?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. We can prove that. Back in 1967, the United States Air Force decided they were going to commission a civilian study of UFOs, the so-called Condon Committee at the University of Colorado. The problem with that is we have in our possession what we call the Hippler letter. It was a letter written by an Air Force lieutenant colonel to Condon saying, this is what we want you to find. And if you don't find this, then the Air Force is going to be stuck investigating these things for another 20 years. So clearly the Air Force was attempting to stifle the information. There's also the ridicule factor, the laugh curtain, if you will, that comes down. Oh, you saw a flying saucer? Well, you must be crazy. What were you drinking? Not, gee whiz, what information can we learn from this observation? It's, oh, you must be crazy. So clearly there's an attempt by governments to suppress the information and the documentation that is available all over the place. I mean, legitimate documentation, not the bogus ones we see so often, but the legitimate documentation suggests that.
Your ex-forces, why are they stifling it?
That's the question I cannot answer. I can tell you why in 1947 it would have made sense. In 1947, and you in Britain would know more so than we in the United States, was we just come out of a very devastating war. And if we're suddenly presented with a technology that we do not understand, created by an alien race we do not understand, I think they wanted an opportunity to determine what was going on without having to worry about all the ancillary things that might happen. And I think that in 1947 it made perfect sense for them to try to bury this and get a handle on it before they announced what they had. Why that secrecy persists to today, I do not understand. I think we're much more sophisticated than we were in 1947. We're used to space flight. I mean, people have walked on the moon. There's literally hundreds of satellites orbiting, satellite TV. We communicate with each other across vast distances that were virtually impossible not that long ago. So I don't understand why it persists today, but it does. And we saw that again in the mid-1990s when the Air Force investigated the Roswell case and presented the same answer then that they had come out with 1947. They said in 1947, that's a weather balloon. And they said in 1995, we lied about that. It wasn't a weather balloon. It was a weather balloon. They just dressed it up in new language and new clothes and suggest Project Mogul was highly classified. Well, the purpose was, but the project itself was not. So, you know, more evidence that they're suppressing the information. But why they feel the need to do that in today's environment, I do not know.
Kevin, I'm an older man. Years ago, we would never in a million years have had this conversation. It just would never have happened. Why do you think now? Why do you think people are now really curious about whatever is out there?
I think one of the problems that we would have had 50 or 60 years ago is that we all accepted that the government, for the most part, were there to help us. I mean, the government was there to provide for the common defense. The government was there to make sure things ran smoothly. The government wouldn't lie to us. And in the last 50, 60 years, and I hesitate to say it only because it makes the United States government look bad, but we've got all these instances where the government didn't operate in the best interest of the citizens. We had the Tuskegee syphilis experiments in the 1930s and 40s. It persisted into the 1970s, where they did not treat the African Americans who had syphilis. Instead, they studied the course of the disease, giving them placebos. And so we've learned that the governments operate in their own self-interest. We understood at one point that corporations operated in their own self-interest. They weren't interested in public safety. They weren't interested in doing good for the public. They were interested in making money for their stockholders. We thought governments were different. We've learned since then that governments are not different, that they've done these sorts of things, and we have access to all this information now through the Internet and every other thing that we have that shows us that some things are just not as we've been told.
I'm talking to Kevin D. Randall, who's got a new book out, Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky, A History of Famous Incidents, Conspiracies and Cover-ups. What will people get from this book? Tell us about the book.
The book itself covers, and somebody actually counted it because I didn't know this, there's 118 incidents in the book. And what I was looking at was on the Internet, some of the counts of UFO crashes top 300, and this is preposterous. If they were raining out of the sky like that, we would have a lot more answers. And I wanted to look at these things with a critical eye and provide the best evidence for the cases I could. And if there were solutions, I wanted to provide the solutions to those cases as well. So I looked at cases all around the world, as a matter of fact, to see what we could determine. Some of the cases clearly are what was called Project Moondust. And Moondust was a U.S. government project that was charged with the recovery of returning space debris of foreign manufacture. Well, foreign manufacturer clearly could mean alien as well. But I think it was directed specifically to pick up bits of Russian stuff. But there are any number of cases that are Project Moondust. And most of those are explainable in the mundane as us returning space debris of foreign manufacture. But I wanted to look at all of those sorts of things and provide the readers with the best information so we could get away from arguing about cases that maybe didn't deserve a second look and arguing and following up on the cases that did deserve further research so we could maybe learn something more about what was going on around us.
You were serving in the Vietnam War and the Second Gulf War, and you evidently have an amazingly open mind about everything. When you were in the war, did you think that maybe they were observing, wondering what the hell we were doing?
Not so much. Not so much in those little brushfire wars. I mean, Vietnam was confined to part of the Asian landmass, and the Gulf War is confined to portions of the Middle East. Not like World War II, where virtually the whole northern hemisphere and parts of the southern hemisphere were involved in the conflict. I think that would have drawn their interest more so than these other smaller conflicts. So I never really thought about that. I did have access when I was in Iraq. I did have access to classified intelligence traffic that was moving back and forth. And I never saw anything that related to UFOs, and I always kept an eye out for that sort of thing. When I was an Air Force intelligence officer, between Vietnam and the Gulf War. And I happened to be in the Army in both the Vietnam and the Gulf War. I just had a short period of service in the Air Force. I looked for that sort of thing, and we had what they called a weekly intelligence brief. And a number of times you'd see an unclassified story in there, which some flight crew had seen something unusual. And the one I remember was they were in the Pacific heading toward Japan when they saw a bright light that followed them for a period of time. But it was unclassified information. So there didn't seem to be a lot of that sort of thing moving through the classified documents that I had access to, and clearly I didn't have access to the top secret stuff. I mean, I was cleared for top secret, but none of the stuff I needed to deal with was classified that high.
Kevin, does it frustrate you as a man who seems to logically think of everything and has written all these books that you will probably never see or get real evidence that you can go, wow?
I am the eternal optimist. I believe I will get the evidence. And I think we were very close in the mid-1990s because we got the Air Force to respond to us, and I think we blew it at that point. We were so busy arguing our own little fiefdoms that we just didn't combine together to take on the Air Force. And the Air Force was able to come up with an explanation that was acceptable to way too many people with their Project Mogul. But I believe that we will find the evidence that we need that will be convincing to the majority of the people. There are people out there that no matter what you presented them in the way of evidence, they just wouldn't accept it. And there's no arguing of those sorts of people. I've been in a couple of those arguments, and every time they say, well, you don't have blah, 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 and I said, yes, here it is. They said they moved the goalposts on us and say, no, what I really meant was this. And a prime example was someone had told or said that, you know, you have nothing from Jesse Marcel Jr.'s friends at the time that talked about, he didn't talk to his friends about seeing the flying saucer. And we had found a woman who'd actually was a few years older than he was and had been his babysitter when he was younger, and he talked to her about that. And we said, see, yes, here's one of the people that he talked to, and she's told us what she knew about this. And they said, well, you didn't talk to her in 1947. And I thought, well, I wasn't born in 1947. Nobody was looking at this in 1947. You set a parameter. We met that parameter. We found friends of Jesse Marcel who he talked to this about. And now you're changing the conditions of the question by saying you wanted somebody from further back. So what we present in the way of evidence sometimes will make no difference to some people.
For people like you that are really interested in this and make a living out of UFOs and looking into the sky, do these movies, the sort of movies that Spielberg brings out, that once comes to mind, actually do you a disservice?
I don't think so. I thoroughly enjoyed Independence Day. I think what harms us more is what we think of as a lunatic fringe. And the people who are claiming that they are in mental communication with the people from another world, or do automatic writing where they're getting directions from people from another world, or they are claiming that they've been to planets outside the solar system, now outside the solar system. In the 50s, they were all inside the solar system, talking about their trips aboard the flying saucers. And I think that does a real disservice because it kind of lumps us all together as part of the lunatic fringe. You know, I try to maintain a scientific methodology and a scientific rationale in my research. Too often we get dragged into those sorts of things. And you get invited to speak at a conference, and sometimes the problem is those people are invited to speak at the conference as well, and there's people who want to hear what they have to say. And so do you go to the conference lending a certain amount of legitimacy to it by attending, or do you not go and let your message go unheard? So it's kind of a dilemma. But that's where we run into the trouble, is with what we think of as lunatic fringe.
The internet must have opened up so much for you to find information, to meet other people that believe in what you believe. That must have changed everything.
Well, if my blog site, I've got a flag counter on there now, and as of today, I've had hits from 130 different countries. And the last one is from Isle of Man, by the way.
Oh, right.
As a coincidence, which surprised me. But there's a great deal of interest throughout the world on the topic, and there's people looking at my blog from around the world. There's the Magonia Log, a blog which is based there in Great Britain, and they've had hits from 120 countries around the world as well. So there's a great deal of interest. The problem with the internet is that you have to be able to filter the information. And I was just having a discussion with somebody about the old Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, you have the book there and you look something up and you have the opinion of that particular topic from that particular writer, and it may be skewed in some fashion. With the internet, you can get everybody's opinion, so you can get a diversity of opinion on a topic, but then you have to be able to discriminate between what is good, legitimate information and what is not that good at all. And a really good example is I was just for fun reading about the gunfight at the OK Corral in the 1880s, you know, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. And I found a website that was hosted by the Clanton family. And, of course, their take on the gunfight is completely different than what everybody else is. And I found it interesting, you know, the Clanton family, of course, they're supporting their relatives from the gunfight at that time. But it was interesting to see that opposing viewpoint, which, if you read it in an encyclopedia, you may not get that sort of thing. You may just get the one side of the issue. So the internet has opened it up so that you can look at all points of view, and you can decide what is the best information available.
Apart from your new book, if you wanted people out there to buy just one book of all those books, which is a vast amount of books, which one would you want them to read most? Which one means more to you?
I think Scientific Ufology, which is trying to bring the scientific method to look at UFOs, trying to present the evidence, whether it is evidence from instrumentality, whether it is physical evidence of some kind, whether it's testimonial evidence, whether it's photographic evidence, to look at all of that evidence and study it from that point of view. I know that since my books have been published, there's been a program on the Science Channel which was called Meteorite Men, and these are guys who go out and they look for meteors. And what they had was some footage of meteor falls that had been videotaped and digitally recorded over the last few years. And I found those recordings fascinating because if you looked at them quickly, they began to look like some of the descriptions we had of UFOs and things like that. And I think that, I would say that the Childs Whitted sighting from 1948, which was a very, very puzzling for a long time, I think it may have been solved by a bolide. So I think, you know, our information expands, we learn more things. But if you're looking for a book, I think Scientific Ufology is a very good one. The Abduction Enigma, which I did with Russ Estes and Bill Cohn, looks at the abduction phenomenon as completely as possible, and we provide terrestrial explanations for an awful lot of what's going on in the abduction field. And I think that's an important book that got overlooked because it suggests terrestrial explanations for the abduction. So the abduction community railed against us. I know that I was at one point on Bud Hopkins' enemy list because of the book.
Tell me, how do they find your blog and how do they find your books?
The books are on Amazon.com, which everybody can find. The blog is called kevinrandle.blogspot.com, and the Randle is R-A-N-D-L-E, not the conventional spelling. But if you type a different perspective into your search engine, it should come up in the first or second point, and you just click on that and go to the blog.
Kevin, final question. What do you want people to take from this new book, Crash?
I would like them to come away from that realizing that many of the tales of crashes are misidentifications, that there's mundane explanations for an awful lot of them, but there's a couple of them that are extremely mysterious, and we need to get to the bottom of those so we'll really know what's going on.
Kevin D. Randle, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Liverpool's biggest after-hours talk show, Late Night City, with Pete Price on Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9.